Welcome back to Find a Way, brought to you by the Show and Tell Neighborhood. I'm your host, Colin Whitlock, and you have successfully arrived at part two of my conversation with Maggie Clifford. Please stick around at the end of the episode. We have an exclusive release of Maggie's new single, I Can Pretend. It's a beautiful, poignant song. Her voice, I'm not going to try to describe it. When you listen to it, you know what I mean. You're going to go, her voice, I really think you're going to like it, or at least I really like it, and I would love to share it with you. I'm honored that Maggie shared it with us. So thank you, Maggie. Thank you for finding your way here today. Enjoy the rest of our conversation.
Dang.
So yeah, that's when it started, sixth grade, I guess. I was playing drums in that band. But
okay, so clearly I have this theory.
Okay, go on.
Around, in my own personal experience with solo performing, I think the first time that I had this overwhelming sense of anticipatory anxiousness, yes, before a performance was maybe, I was in the Eastman Bach Children's Choir in Rochester, New York.
Ooh.
And we had learned this song, and I and two other people, and I was one of the youngest people in the chorus, had been, I've never talked about this really,
but
I've thought about it. So I would have been I was in elementary school.
Okay.
So maybe I was in fourth grade, and the people who I was going to be doing this like solo thing with were maybe in middle school, seventh, eighth grade,
okay,
something like that. So it wasn't a solo proper, but it was the three of us on the backdrop of these other hundreds of kids that had auditioned from around the area, singing in front of hundreds of people in this like big auditorium. I recall a sort of like giddiness, but an extreme anxiety, overwhelm.
Yes.
And mind blank. I momentarily forgot what the words were, and I remember giggling with the other two people. It was a boy and a girl, and just being, what are the words? You know, after, you know, it was, yeah.
I totally know that one.
Yes.
Yeah.
And but then, you know, you're met with, after the song is over, a thunderous applause. And even if it's really, if it's good or bad, who knows? We were just a bunch of cute kids,
yeah,
singing a song or two, you know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Totally.
And so I have this theory about our experiences with performance there, like yielding a learned, lived experience of running toward the danger and having immediate, loud, and vocalized positive feedback.
Mm.
So which is different than a sports game. You can get a lot of positive feedback from making that free throw shot in,
yep,
the last 5 seconds of that game. But it's still different than the, you perform a thing, you get an applause. You were on the stage at the end. I was in some musical theater stuff in high school, and just having that experience of the clapping, it's just like, it's a crazy biochemical experience and spiritual experience.
Sure.
To go through the dark night of the soul, like, oh no, I can't remember a single line that I, blah, 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 to then be like, oh my God, you're pretty much a hero. Like, I've never seen something like this before. At least that's when you're a child. It's like, I mean, I don't even know if it's really like it, you don't really internalize it like that, but it's still this like very clear exchange of extreme like fear, anxiety, sweat, you know,
yes,
to extreme jubilation and release of like insane pleasure chemicals in your body, you,
yes,
know?
Yes.
Which is why the music industry is so effed for so many people. One of the reasons why it's effed for people to do it full time. There's research now on that. We're not going to go that. But so that's like a theory that I have too about like, people who have had those experiences, I notice, it's easier. I'm not saying that this kind of person who's had these kinds of performance experiences are the only ones that will go towards their risk, their danger, the danger that they love.
I think that's a great example, though, because I can, for me personally at least, I can so relate this running toward the danger concept to that moment right before you start to sing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in my experience, not having any sort of classical training for singing,
mm-hmm,
being told, you know, at times that I have a strong voice,
mm-hmm,
things like that growing up. When I first started, I really consider my performance my experience performing to start my freshman year of college or so, when I started doing open mic nights and things, I had putting together my first band in college. Mm-hmm. That's really when I was like concentrating on
it.
Did
you go to college here?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, UF. Mm-hmm.
Wait, were you and like Sam and Michael and all, were you all in college together?
No, okay, I didn't meet them until like mid to late 2000.
Okay.
Like,
yeah. Sorry, that was a little bit of a side. Yeah. Just curious. Okay.
But yeah, I had a band, my college years, and whether I was playing by myself or with the band, there was always this moment before we'd start where the temptation to hold back was there because I was scared, you know, and especially if I'm doing like harmonies, things like that, this temptation is sort of sit back from the mic a little bit. And
I still do that.
And probably every single time I held back, I wouldn't hit the right note. I wouldn't sound very
for
good.
Sure.
It wouldn't be it. But the challenge though, is this thought like, yeah, but if I give it my all, and I hit the wrong note, then it's going to be loud and wrong, as opposed to like quiet and wrong. Guaranteed quiet wrong.
Mm-hmm. Is it guaranteed though that you're quiet?
It just, I mean, like
maybe for you.
Yeah, I mean, but I
because it comes from like timidity or whatever.
Yeah, and because it's this dialogue between me and my vocal cords, you know, where I'm like, I don't believe in you. And so they're like, you know, they don't want to give it to me.
One of the coolest findings that I've come across so far in the past couple of years teaching in arts and medicine is that the body releases different chemicals based on whether or not you are solo performing, singing in a group, whether or not you are, like, if you're drumming in a circle is different than drumming on a stage.
Wow.
Like, and the differences are around, like, dopamine and oxytocin. They've looked at, like, salivary content of, like, dopamine and oxytocin, just for example. And then also looking qualitatively at people's experiences with, for example, singing solo. I still have sort of overwhelming nervousness when singing, especially in front of students. And the way that I've theorized that is because of it's like it's a mashup of roles. So it's not really clear. They're there to, quote unquote, learn. And even though there's like their music themes in all the courses that I teach, it's not like you're not there to learn how to sing or to hear me sing. And so even though, like, for me, there are learning objectives in doing that, and sometimes even just talking to them about my experience of feeling nervous singing in front of them is a part of the learning experience, to be like, hey, even though I have like the internet says I'm a credible professional musician.
Right.
Okay. There is no reason apparently that I should feel nervous singing in front of you. I have a lot of, I've credibilitata up the wah-wah, you know what I mean? But I am, and it's normal, but I personally enjoy it. Like, I feel like, oh, that was something kind of fun that I experienced, you know, to feel nervous and to go through that whole process again. And I'm like, anyway.
Oh, for sure. And that dynamic is so weird, too. I remember bringing my guitar into class every once in a while in middle school. Rarely. Mm-hmm. Not when I was in middle school, when I taught middle school. Mm-hmm. And my hands would shake.
I know. But, you like, so this other thing that I would love to develop, like, further, this other idea, like a fledgling just N of one type theory is around the felt experience of performing, especially singing in front of a group, as the experience of life or death, like the risk being experienced as that high because of the capacity for rejection and how the rejection itself would be felt as death because it's the entire community,
right?
You know, right there, whoever that community is in that moment is everyone in the world.
There is that, yeah, it does feel as though there's that risk, especially, you know, with catastrophic failure. You know, even when we do a shitty Beatles show, you know, we've been playing long enough where the crowd comes excited
together,
you know, and they do come together
right then and now.
Mm-hmm.
Great band, by the way, love
thanks.
It. Yeah. But I always call it the shoddy Beatles because that's the press I see.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
We don't correct people.
Yes. Well, it's on the freaking flyers, man.
Yeah. You know.
The shoddy music. Okay. So, yes, even at those shows or something.
Even at those shows with the crowd, they want to sing. Mm-hmm. They want to dance. They it's such a beautiful relationship that we have with them because, you know, we're still very excited to play the songs and still, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff. But regardless of this, really optimal situation we have, I know that there's some level of mistake that could make it all come crashing down.
So exciting. You know? So exciting.
Something could go wrong.
Exhilaration.
There is, we for a long time, our encore would be Helter Skelter, mm-hmm. and it would be at the end of this long night, and I've really, given it my all night. Mm-hmm. I'm drenched in sweat and everything. Mm-hmm. I'm tired and probably dehydrated. And then we would go and do Helter Skelter, and I would, I scream those parts, and I really get into it, and I'm jumping around, because I don't have my piano in front of me. I don't have an instrument, so that's weird. Mm-hmm. You know the ceiling, mm-hmm. although you've mastered it.
LOL.
So I feel awkward. So, I'm dancing. I'm trying to, emote and things like that. And there are I would say 9 times out of 10, there is some moment where I'm, really belting it out where mm-hmm. I feel like I think I might throw up and then pass out. Right
oh,
now.
Really?
This is just...
From the overwhelming...
After being so tired, it's like, mm-hmm. running a marathon and then being asked to play a game of soccer, it's like, all right, let's mm-hmm. do this, and mm-hmm. there'll be a moment where I think if I push it much harder, I'm going to spew all over the audience.
You're going to spew
onto them.
Right onto their heads. That's the line.
And so I think that could be the thing that kills this. If I spewed all over the audience, that could
this is the
it.
Thing that could send me to prison. Banishment. I'm going Rikers. Straight to Rikers. Right. See ya. Right.
Worth it.
Loved every minute. Yeah. Now I just want to go to a live show.
We haven't played in over a year. We haven't played since January 1st, 2024. I think
that's time. The perception of time changes, doesn't it?
Yes, it
because
does.
Because that does not feel long ago anymore.
Yeah.
It took me a second. I was like, it's March. It's St. Patty's Day.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah. We're already more than halfway through March, which is also really weird.
My birthday is next week.
Really?
Yeah.
What day?
The Tuesday, March 25th.
Nice. That's my mm-hmm. grandfather's birthday.
We are buddies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Buds.
Right on. I knew there was a reason why we got along so well.
Is he still with us?
He's not.
Okay.
Actually, he was. He was one of my first experiences that made me feel that there was more.
How old were you?
I was 16. He died mm-hmm. when I was 16.
You were close to him.
Yeah, I was close to him. I think his death made me realize how distant I was, actually. His death is probably one of the biggest turning points in mm-hmm. my life because he was somebody that I considered I considered myself very close to. And then when he died, I realized I knew so little about him. Mm. And I realized that...
Because you're a child.
Yeah, because I was a kid. I learned to really hate that dynamic of being held... having information held back from me because Ooh. I'm a child, right? When I realized, all of his friends knew this different guy. They knew Jim mm-hmm. as
Jimbo.
Whoever. Not Sorry. My grandpa. Yeah,
yes,
Jim
right.
could be. Mm-hmm. There's probably a Jimbo out there who, I mean, mm-hmm. somebody called him Jimbo. Mm-hmm. They knew all these stories about him that I'd never know. They had all these experiences with him that, were not available to me to know, even if I asked about them.
Mm.
And then I started thinking what was his relationship like with my grandma when they first mm. met? What were some of their more intimate moments together?
Was this all around when you were 16 or as the years wore on?
It went as the years went on, but I would say it started mm. at 16 because mm. I remember searching their condo for a journal, mm-hmm. hoping that he had a journal
Kept
that I
thoughts.
Could, you know...
Please burn my journals.
Yeah, really?
I don't know. Anyway, that's an aside.
Me start keeping a journal. I mean, there like all of those up there, up there. Those are all journals that I started after that because I became determined that, you know, okay, I don't want somebody to read this while I'm alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be great if I felt comfortable enough letting somebody read them while I'm alive. But
you don't need to burn my journals. Future generations listening to this.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, like, when I die, if I have family and they want to know who I was, like, unabashedly, I want them to see, like, this is who Grandpa was. This is who, you know.
So that they can multifacetedly, intellectually resonate with you.
Yeah. I want them to see that, like, I think I'm really, especially in these last 10 years or so, I'm really pushing back, and I'm trying to work with a lot of parents on this too, pushing back against this trend that I think was very common with the boomer generation and generations before them, to build this sort of like impeccable image for themselves. Mm. Like, I am the guardian and master of this home. My decisions are not to be questioned. They are infallible. And therefore, it makes it impossible for me to be accountable for my mistakes. Makes it impossible for me to, you know, try to amend some of those things.
Yeah. Domination and of the home.
I just want them to see, you know, like, I was flawed. I had, look at this early journal. Look at how, you know, mistakenly misogynistic I was at this time. Mm-hmm. And like, look at me, like, grow. Mm-hmm. Watch me, like, realize the things that were baked into me that I didn't like. Watch me, you know, just so that, like, I think that kids and just humans in general need to see that arc.
I have a bit of a different perspective on this now. Like, I look at someone, you probably never heard of her, but her name is Taylor Swift. And she has a very publicly available documentation of certain emotional flashpoints, to what extent they feel like real depictions to her of emotional past, present, future visioning kind of things is, you know, up for conversation, and it will be discussed in scholarly circles for a long time, I think.
Yeah.
But I look at her, and I mean, I was never aspiring to be Taylor Swift, but I did write songs at the same ages that she did,
yes,
my own original works. And I am so grateful that I'm still alive. You were talking about after you passed, stuff like that. But I am so grateful that those songs are not published on the internet. I'm so grateful that they're not accessible. And for two reasons. One, because they were extremely intimate and extremely reflective of my own immaturity, as you were sort of talking about. But as an object itself on its own, and I'm thinking about this in terms of like a journal entry, because you can never guarantee that someone's going to read all of your journal entries, So like looking at a couple of the flashpoints or whatever that would have been represented in this like recorded object that people could listen to, I think about not only its effects on like my own children, like, whoa, why do you have a song that has the word rape in it? You know, like, and I, just for the record, it wasn't about a rape experience, but the word rape is in it. And I'm so pleased that moment of my like intellectual, spiritual, emotional development is not encapsulated in an accessible form, that like there's a part of me that when I say you don't need to burn my journals, I'm thinking because a lot of my journals are filled with like poems that you can have multiple interpretations. They're not like a daily, it's not like a, most of them are not like outlines of like, or detailed stories or something like that. But they're very intimate and they would spark a lot of conversation with people in my intimate circle. I think, I don't know. I talk about it with my friends, but just to put, I think about Taylor Swift and like having to, I mean, she makes so much money and she became a billionaire, you know, and I don't believe in billionaires, but she is one, whatever. I can't imagine having to relive those things and to have it like there.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that discomfort for sure. I think my
but it's different than, it is different than journals as an example, obviously. Sorry,
well, but I like your example, actually. I think that's a great one because it is out there then. And mm-hmm. and I think your fear is well-founded, or at least your discomfort
well,
is well-founded.
Oh, sorry. I didn't finish totally because a part of my gratitude for not having that out there is because the object itself would replicate that immature perspective. It would not dismantle the immature perspective because there's no other objects to show change over time through the one narrator, the artist in this case being me, mm-hmm. showing an evolution of any kind. And like, so it's just like this one thing, this one perspective that I had when I was 20 or 21 that I now look back on, I'm like, oh wow, that's, I mean, it's valid because it was my experience at the time, but it no longer feels true to me in a way that I feel like it could replicate or reify like harmful perspectives under the guise of like, oh, this sounds true.
Certainly. I mean, I think that that is a danger. I think that phrase, like, it doesn't feel true anymore, is one of the most important aspects of your perspective in this, and that, like, it doesn't feel true in the present. Mm-hmm. And it's because it exists in the past. You know, this, it was true at the time. And
I feel like I didn't even know what I was saying, actually.
Right. Well, and that's the truth. That's mm-hmm. what I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, that's truth is such like a language in general, as we learn from telepathy tapes. Mm-hmm. Language is so limiting, and it's
yes,
so
right.
It's such a dangerous medium of communication.
It's so arduous. Yes.
And that's why, you know, art to me, or just expression to me, is a thing that. Even when it doesn't feel true anymore, is a thing that exists regardless, is a thing that deserves to exist regardless, because it's representing a moment, right? And mm-hmm. one of the things that I push for, which makes a lot of people uncomfortable, and I understand why, my feeling is that if a thing exists and it is true, mm-hmm. then it should be up for discussion, you know, even if it's uncomfortable to an extent. Yeah, those things. I mean, so again, going back to like the example with my grandfather, I wanted to have some like, he's gone, you know, he left, he's gone, mm-hmm. and I don't get the nitty gritty about him anymore. I only get what the living people are willing to tell me, right? Mm-hmm. I can't get those, you know. I don't know. I just want to know who here's this person I was supposed to be really close with. I want to really know.
But so how does this relate to, I have to hear this part. How does this relate to your change, it sounded like, your change in perspective on the so-called afterlife?
I've had a couple of experiences with people who have died who... these take place either like some of them feel a little bit like dreams, some of them mm-hmm. feel a little bit like out of body experiences. Mm-hmm. So I've had an experience with three different people who I was close with who died. I visited me that night mm-hmm. and spoke to me. Mm-hmm. So that was significant, and it felt different than just like I'm having a dream. It was yes. like, I'm aware, I know what's happening, you know, I'm, mm-hmm. So with my grandfather, that was the one that felt the most like a dream because it was mm-hmm. kind of like odd, but I was very much aware and awake. Mm-hmm. And I had this experience where I was at they had a condo in Florida, and they had, my uncle had a bottom floor of an apartment that they would stay at for the summers, mm-hmm. Up in New York. And
where in New York?
In Albany, okay. Or in Rensselaer, actually, okay. Near Albany.
I'm from Rochester. Did I say that?
Oh, no, you didn't say that. Okay. Interesting. That's near. That's mm-hmm. close.
Well, a few hours, yeah.
Yeah, more. That's kind of close. So, yeah, I had the... my grandfather died. I had this chance to go see him the night that he died. I had a chance to get, they lived a couple blocks away. My parents were going to go down, just check in, say hello. And I didn't want to because it was like I was a teenager and it was like
for sure.
Weird and whatever.
And it was the first death in your close.
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah. I mean, my aunt died when I was like 8. You know, another aunt, a great aunt.
These were great aunts, yeah.
Okay. But I was, you know, she babysat me and stuff like that. But yeah, this was the first person that it like really hit me hard. And it had been a long, you know, it was rough. So I chose not to see him. He died that night. I was like, oh, I can't believe I didn't get a chance to say hello or to just whatever. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I had this... I went to bed, and my experience when I have these things is like I kind of like close my eyes and then I start, you know, you don't, most people, I guess, I assume, don't know when they fall asleep. They don't feel it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I would have this like almost like vibration in me, this like buzzing in me. And it was almost like, you know, it was almost like being drunk or like getting high or something. It was like a weird buzzing. And then all of a sudden I'm like at the door of their condo.
Wait, so the buzzing was only happening that night, or it was happening regularly while you were trying to go to sleep?
It would happen on these occasions.
Oh, on these, okay, gotcha.
These, like, out-of-body, weird...
Wait, where do you feel the buzzing? Just
It's, like, whole body.
Whole body, okay.
It usually starts in my head.
In your head.
Like, front, like...
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
From the forehead. And then it kind of just, like, resonates throughout the whole body. I feel it in my chest intensely. And there's like a feeling of like, gosh, I don't know how to explain it. But there is a feeling of separation. There's a feeling
from your
body.
Yeah.
And it's these times I've had this experience many other times. And sometimes I'm trying to induce it because I want to learn how to do this.
Yeah, right.
But I get scared. And it ruins it. It ends it. But these experiences, like when I've experienced losing somebody and I'm sad and I'm having an intense emotion, it's a very quick transition. There's no time to get scared. I'm just, I'm there, you know?
And the mission is clear.
The mission is clear.
I feel like with a lack of clear mission, it can be scary.
For sure. Yeah. And I've had one that was lack of a clear mission that was scary, but it ended up being really moving.
Interesting.
But yeah, with this one, yeah, I just showed up in front of their condo and I went inside. And the dreamlike aspect of this was that the front half of this room was the condo, but the back half, it was the front half of the condo. The back half of the room was the front half of their apartment in New York.
Right,
so it was like the two
places.
Front rooms together. My grandfather was sitting in the back of this room, which was the front of the apartment. He was sitting by the windows. My grandmother and an aunt from the other side of my family who had passed away, they were on the condo side, this Florida side, and they were having an argument about a dollar. Like, grandpa left one of them a dollar, and they were arguing over it. And I went past them, and I went up to my grandpa, and he was holding his newspaper the way he used to, you know, just sit by the chair, by the front door, reading his newspaper. And he kind of, like, curled down his newspaper and looked at me, and I was like, oh, my God. I mean, like, I'm so sorry I didn't get a chance to say goodbye, and I didn't get a chance to tell you I love you, which I didn't tell him very often anyway. And he just, like, if you knew him, his response obviously was perfect. He was just kind of, like, nodded and was like, I know, you know, and he was a very like chill guy like that. And he was also brilliant, like this like absent-minded professor type. And like the door opened and I looked back and like this great wind started coming through and things started going nuts in the room. The windows started going up and down and the drapes were flying and my grandma and aunt didn't seem to notice anything.
Yeah.
And he just looked at me and was like, oh, looks like you better get out of here. You know, like you better get going.
It's time to go.
Yeah. And I just remember I'm getting chills talking about it. Yeah. And yeah, it was just this like very clear, like it was nice to know that he knew.
Yes.
And it was good. I don't know. I could talk about this for way too long, but I walked away with a lot of like understanding that there, and wishing that I could talk longer about this very subject because I think it's important. But I walked away with this general understanding that like part of what is after or part of what exists beyond us is within us.
Yes. And, yes. Correct. And I mean, yes.
Like my impression of who he was always within me.
Yes.
Even if he's gone.
Yes.
I've got this like thing in me. So as long as I keep a door open to it, then that's still there. And it solves this problem that I have in my head of like, well, if we die and like, what are you going to spend eternity like coming to talk to me? And like, you know, like, oh God, I, you know, it's another year. I got to sit around before I can start this over again. Or, you know, and instead it's like, no, they've, you know, I've just got this thing in me that is like connected.
Yes.
And it doesn't involve my grandpa, like in some realm of like, all right, is he going to call on me again? I'm going to, all right, he's calling. I better go talk to him in this dream. You know?
And to go back to what we very first were talking about, that is exactly what I mean when I say the past and the future exist now, because they are existing through us. And I feel like this point is easier to cognitively wrap your head around, because if you think, oh, the only way that I experience the future is through envisioning it, thinking about it, fretting about it, looking forward to it.
Right.
It is the same about the past. And we do change the past. You don't even have to think about the multiverse. You change the past based on the information that you become privy to, that you imagine, that you engage with in the present. The past changes.
Yes.
Our understanding of the past changes. And I don't know if this will continue in the same way that maybe that it has for our generation, which is going from the textbook as the only historical document we're exposed to.
That's right.
To the polyphonic mass distributed user generated content social media spheres that we inhabit now, and as far as like an information access landscape, and all of the media that's exploring ideas like this, like the Marvel Universe is going hard into it. I don't know if you're into that at all.
No, I'm just learning about it.
Yeah, we've been going pretty hard in that universe for a while. But that's precisely what I mean, is that it's all there within us, and it's not just like merely thoughts. It's like it's just what it is.
Exactly. Retrocausal. Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I mean, just this idea that the future does affect the past, you know, that that and the present affects the past, and
that's something I go into a lot with my work in climate change, is like thinking about not only like one chapter of my dissertation looks at the language used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to talk about the future. And I found that I think that there was an overprivileging of undesirable futures and sort of condemning the readers of those reports to a bleak future, to one bleak future.
Yes.
And I don't find that to be a particularly useful imaginary for us to work with.
Right.
And I also find it false, mainly because it's so easily falsifiable, because you can't have just one future.
Right.
Even when you're talking about the so-called one planet that we live on. Many worlds, many days.
Many minds,
mini minds.
I was going to say that.
Mega minds. So, thank you for being on my podcast.
Yes, it's my pleasure.
It's been great having you here.
Yeah.
And I'll see myself out.
That'd be great. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. This was fun.
It was a pleasure.
We'll have to have a part two, because we had to go a lot of places before we could get to, because there's
much.
Some passing experiences that I've had too recently.
I'm so glad you said that, because I was going to beg if you didn't. So I would love for you to come back.
I'll have to think about. This one I can share. I won't go into the details actually, but I will say that was around when Bob McPeak passed, in 2022. I guess I can do it succinctly. The night that he passed, again, he had gone into like hospice care for a few weeks in a lot of pain. Da, da, da. And the night that he died, I woke up in the night and my eyes were open. I was awake, and, there was no physical or visual indication that there was Bob McPeak there. And we had had philosophical conversations about non-attachment, stuff like that, and other things. But I was lying in the bed in the darkness, And it was an experience unlike any I've had before because I was fully awake. But looking around the room, there was no naming of objects. There was no, it was a visceral experience of non-attachment. And which actually is the experience that led me to the peaceful plasma, like, hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Because in part because of this experience, but also I have read many near-death experience accounts, you know?
Me too.
And so in that moment when I had my eyes open, and it was like minutes of this new felt experience of non-attachment, non-identification with objects and things and the room that I sleep in. My children were there too. And they were beings there with me. There was no non-judgment, non-attachment, non-identification. And, but in the moment too, I was like, I had an intuition, but I was not like, I could not say for sure, oh, this is Bob.
Right.
Because that made me feel like it could make it go away.
Of course.
If I was like, oh, this is Bob. But the thought came, oh, this is Bob. Like, this is Bob showing me this experience, you know? And then when I found out the next morning that he had passed that night, I was like, oh, that was Bob. Like,
yeah.
Thanks, Bob. Like, that was intense, like, in a good way. Like, not intense, scary. Like, that was, like, really profound. And it was also nice to be able to share it with some of his friends when there was, like, memorial stuff in the coming days and weeks. And they were ready to get down. Like, Hoach was like, yeah, sounds right. And
I was like, yeah.
Anyway, so...
that's good. I'm glad
that's
they're...
just a little teaser.
I'm glad that they were into it. I made the mistake once of, well, I mean, I didn't think it was a mistake, but a very close friend, one of my oldest friends, passed away my second or third year of college. Mm. And I came home for the, and I hadn't, one of my other experiences, which I won't tell.
Yeah, we don't have time for it now.
But yeah, I had one of those experiences. And I just had to tell his brother. You know, I felt like I had to tell his brother, and I did, and he was not there, you know, and maybe the mistake was just the timing, you know, maybe I didn't need to tell him at the funeral.
It could be.
Or the wake.
What I think about that too is that, because back to the youth thing, like, we can accidentally tell something because we want to share the experience, but then as we get older, we can realize either how to tell it or how to tell something about it that is in service to the well-being of the other person, rather than just our own need to express. And that's actually an issue I have with that song, is that I felt that song was written from a need for me to process an emotion, which, again, doesn't make it any less true.
Right.
But it was not from a place of, like, what am I communicating to other? How am I being of service to other? You know, however I can imagine it. And that's,
well, and I think that that's probably the reason why it didn't ever get popular. Like, it wasn't meant to be.
Well, I never published it. I only ever performed it live. And yeah.
So that, and I mean, if I think if it was meant to be big, if you were meant to be big at that time, then you would have put it out and it would have been an anthem.
Would have been an anthem
and destroyed the world.
And then recreated it in goddess's image.
Hot damn.
That's us. Okay, I really gotta go.
Yeah, you gotta get out of here. Shoo.
Okay, bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
See you next time. Whoa. 44 notifications. Oh, dear God. Mommy.
You're in trouble. Thank you for finding your way here today, tonight, this afternoon. Thank you to Dr. Maggie Clifford for sitting down with me, talking with me, cracking me up. Maggie is so much fun to talk with. She has a way of stretching my brain in a very satisfying way. She also cracks me up, as you can tell. I was laughing a lot. I really hope we get a chance to do it again. I hope you enjoyed yourself as much as I did. I hope you found that your brain was stretched to an adequate and a pleasing tension. And I hope that tension was broken by lots of laughter with us. I imagine it was. If you have not gotten your fill of Maggie, you can find her all over the place. If you're smart, you will go to the next live show that she plays. She plays in Gainesville a lot. She plays a lot in general. She is a Gainesville favorite. If you've ever heard her play before, you know why. If you have not, then I suggest you go find out. It's very enjoyable. Maggie's voice is absolutely beautiful, which you're about to find out in just a minute here. You can also find Maggie on the streaming platforms, you know, Spotify, Apple Music, Quo Buzz. I don't know how to pronounce that one, but I just learned about this alternate streaming platform, which maybe I shouldn't refer to it as alternate. Maybe I should refer to it as equal, if not maybe better, streaming platform. I haven't tried it yet, so I shouldn't say, but I do know that they pay their artists twice what Apple Music pays, and Apple Music already pays about twice of what Spotify pays. So I know that, and I know they do like deep dives on the artists and things like that. Anyways, I'm getting off topic. I hope that you can find Maggie on that platform as well. You can find Maggie on her website, maggieclifford.com. It's that easy. You can find her on Instagram. I believe her name is Dr. Mags to Witches to You. You don't have to memorize that. I'm going to list these links and things like that in the show description. I just want to make sure you have the opportunity to connect with Maggie and see what a wonderful impact she has on our community and on you as well. So go for it. I have further thanks for you. I promise I'm not going to ramble too much because I have one of Maggie's songs that I'm going to feature here at the end of the episode, and I know that that's why you're sticking around. So I'm just going to say a quick thank you to those of you who are sticking with me. I just had sort of an unplanned break from the podcast game for months. The last time I published a podcast was with Larson McBride back in February, I believe. And this conversation with Maggie was recorded on St. Patrick's Day. So I unexpectedly got busy to the point that I could not get myself to put out the episodes. I was away for the summer. And so I am just now sort of like pulling it together to put out more episodes. And I'm starting off with a couple of bangers because this one with Maggie obviously was really fun and fascinating. My next one is another episode that I've been sitting on since March with Haley Moses Hillman. Some of the most beautiful conversations I've ever had, just in general, not just recorded. Just Haley and I really connect. We are open books together. And when that happens, we really get going. And it's a long one, too, so I'm probably going to break it into pieces. All that being said, I appreciate you sticking with me, and I appreciate you being patient with me. And I intend to put out episodes again on a regular basis. So please tell your friends, please share the podcast if you could, because I have really missed this. And I said this the last time I put out an episode. This is something I truly love. Doing this podcast is so fulfilling to me. It's really wonderful. So I promised I wasn't going to talk too much. I've already broken my promise. I apologize. Thank you for sticking with me. And thank you for sticking around for Maggie's unreleased single. So this is a Find a Way podcast exclusive, which makes me feel pretty special. And let's face it, we are special folks. So let's all sit back and enjoy Maggie Clifford's new single, I Can Pretend, recorded right here in Gainesville, Florida at Heartwood Studios with Dave Maloche. Thanks, Maggie, and thank you for finding your way here today. Enjoy.
I can pretend that I never meant to say I will refrain from making it plain that I think of you. That I spend my days nearly wasting away thinking of escape and how your sweet eyes saw through my pretty lies. All they did, didn't they? I hold out hope that all of my coping will medicine to make myself grin as you fade away. so you'll never.